We finished with Karl Marx. Let's see, and his dates were 1818 to 1883. And what was his most famous work? Tim?
Das Kapital.
Yeah, that's what it is. Das Kapital. And the second, third, and fourth volumes were issued after his death by Engels. Remember at the close of the manifesto that he and Engels issued, the Communist Manifesto in 1848, he said the proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have the world to win. Working men of the world, unite. And then he led in forming several of these working men's unions. So this was a rising force then, socialism, during this period of time. Nationalism grew. This is something else that we see developing. Increasing nationalism. Germany and Italy are unified during this period of time. Something else we notice especially is the immigration of Europeans, the colonialism. A great wave of immigration coming over from Europe and coming over to the United States, also to Australia and New Zealand. There's a lot of immigration in that area. And during this period of time, who ruled the seven seas? All right, it was England. It was really the day of England's naval supremacy. And the British Navy was the greatest. And during this period, the U.S. knew very rapid territorial expansion, too. We'll touch on that a little later. Now, this is a period when Christianity was being increasingly challenged. And Charles Darwin, whose dates are 1809 to 1882, of course, now lives in this period. Does anyone remember what the name of the book was that he issued in 1859? Well, the title of it was An Origin of Species, On Origin of Species. And in this, of course, he proposes this evolutionary hypothesis of natural selection, and there's a survival of the fittest, and given enough time, you have these new species developing. And this had a very real impact in the thinking world. Maybe Genesis 1 isn't true. Maybe it's not the way it's pictured in the Bible at all. And it seemed to render Genesis 1 obsolete. So you have here the rationalism, and now this evolutionary hypothesis coming up, and people are increasingly questioning. Astronomy and geology, these two fields are growing in their knowledge. And it seemed as if Usher's dates were being completely discredited. And the sad thing was that it had become customary to put Usher's dates in the margin of the King James Bible. I know the first Bible that I received after I became a Christian had the dates in. Well, alongside Genesis 1:1, creation of the world. Does anyone remember what date is he gives? 4004 B.C. There it is. It's in the Bible, isn't it? And of course, it's a note that was put in later, and Usher worked out this chronology around 1650 as best he could, just adding up figures and things like this. Now, his chronology isn't accepted today by biblical students at all, but for most people at that time, this seemed to be the inspired chronology. Astronomy seems to indicate a much older age for this universe, and geology. The study of geology with all of the various layers of rock and seeming to indicate a period of time, a vast period of time. So that here, these things too were seemingly against the Bible in a lot of people's thinking. We'll just touch on a few of the men that stand out as opposing, really, Christianity. We have Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, and his dates 1844 to 1900. Here he is right in this period of time. He came from a line of Protestant clergymen. His grandfather was a clergyman. His father was a clergyman. There's just a whole line here of clergymen. But what was his philosophy? He basically now completely rejects Christianity. He becomes a very strong voice attacking Christianity. And what was his philosophy? What would you say, as you recall? Cheryl? Existentialism? Yeah, perhaps we think more of Kierkegaard in connection with that. The idea of God being dead. Alright. The idea certainly that all of the values that you see for centuries here, the West had held as being right and good. Standards of morality, standards, for example, of kindness. All of these, he said, are signs of weakness. Judaism and Christianity has basically been telling people to be weak. And his emphasis was there should be this will for power. And his goal was, and he longed for a day when Christianity would be wiped out, and when you would have this super race, just taking charge, and here it's just a matter of might overcoming. The strong, are the ones who are to overcome. The weak should be wiped out. There's no room for them. And his philosophy had an impact on many. He rejected all the values that Christians have traditionally held. And he said they were signs of weakness instead of signs of strength. So it's a ruthless philosophy, isn't it? Sort of, in a way, going along with the evolutionary hypothesis here, the survival, you see, of the fittest. Now, Thomas Huxley comes along, and his date's right in this period, too, 1825 to 1895. And he accepted a lot of Darwin. He was a biologist. And he rejected Christianity. He said there's no proof for God. And he took the position of being an agnostic. He said, I just don't know. But there's no proof for God, and I certainly reject Christianity. Another one of these voices, you see, that are coming out attacking Christianity. And these are by men who are intelligent, they're well educated. It seems to be that here Christianity is being rejected, you see, by many of the learned men. During this time, you also have Thomas Paine's Age of Reason being widely read in Britain and the U.S. This is being still published. The Age of Reason. Christianity's outdated. These myths, these fables, the weak need them, the ignorant need them. But here, this is the Age of Reason, and we don't need to be dependent on these things. A man we sometimes think of during this period was Robert Greene Ingersoll. Ingersoll, maybe you've heard that name at times, 1833 to 1899. And he seemed to delight in attacking Christianity. He went around giving lectures against Christianity, lecturing against the Bible, and in his lectures often defying God. And lampooning Christianity, ridiculing. Sort of like Mrs. O'Hare, this kind of approach, where as a popular speaker in that, just a delight to try to point out inconsistencies in the Bible and to make fun and to put down Christianity completely. He was the son of a congregational minister, but a real foe of Christianity. We think of another man who also was a voice that, in a, should I say, in a much more kindly, gentle way, still attack Christianity, and that was Ralph Waldo Emerson during this period. 1803 are his dates, 1882. He was a Unitarian minister, and he had a great influence through his writing and through his speaking. And as a Unitarian, you see, he refused to accept the deity of Christ. Jesus Christ is a man, he's a great man, but he's not God. There's a rejection of miracles and the supernatural, this whole current of things. There's a lot of confidence in man's ability. Man has a right to be optimistic. See, this is the age now when man begins to think he can handle everything. He's making all these discoveries. He can control nature. He's going to be able to control society. And so there was a lot of optimism and idealism here. Now this came to be really hit hard. You remember, by the First World War and then the years that followed. But during this time, there was just a lot of optimism. We don't really need God. We certainly don't need Christianity. And this is much of the thinking that's infiltrating the intellectual world of the day. Another man whose name you may be familiar with, and some of you probably know more about him than I do, is John Dewey. And his date's 1859 to 1952. John Dewey. When you think of John Dewey, from some of your courses, what do you think of? What do you think of, Christy? John Dewey.
All
right. Very real impact on education, didn't he? He was a professor and wrote, lectured widely. What would you say his school of philosophy would be? When you think of his name, John Dewey, what school of philosophy would you connect with him? Well, usually we think of pragmatism, don't we? A pragmatic approach to things. And his particular brand of it is sometimes called the instrumentalist or experimentalist approach. You try something, if it works with you, if it's something that produces, why then it's good to keep. And he rejected the Christian concept of God. John Dewey simply didn't have room, really at all, for the Christian concept of God. For Christianity was left out. And here we are in this new age, an age where things are relative, and it's a pragmatic philosophy. If something really works, keep it. There's no such thing as evaluating things by absolutes, by a supernatural revelation or something like this. You're in the area now of experimenting. And if it works, it's good. Now, another thing that really put Christianity under stress during this period was the migration of millions who came over from Europe to the Americas, to Australia and New Zealand. Why do I say this put a stress on people? If people move great distances, why is this a stress as far as Christianity is concerned? Well, it can be even true in this country. For example, there are many families that will move, say they move from the Midwest or the East, maybe they move out to the West. Nevada, California, Arizona. What sometimes happens with regard to their church connection? Well, it's broken. And sometimes they don't bother to renew it. And you have many people, for example, in moving to, they lose the pressure. See, of the community where all the relatives go, and if you don't go to church, they'll kind of be down on you. And here you're off in a new area, completely away. You have all of the challenge of your environment and the pressures of it, and you don't have the necessity. You don't have the tie with church as you once had. So the danger was here that maybe in doing this, many would be just lost as far as the church were concerned. And also in Europe, the church and state were being separated increasingly. No longer were the church and state tied together. Power of Rome is not the same. It isn't linked with the civil authority. And consequently, Christians are often a minority now instead of the majority. So these are things during this period, just some general things that are putting pressure on Christianity. Christianity is being challenged as never before during this period of time. And we'll notice that when we get into, especially in German thought, as far as the inspiration of scripture and some of these areas. Now let's take a quick look at Roman Catholicism during this period, this century of 1815 to 1914. It really made less progress than Protestantism. Protestantism was growing much more than Roman Catholicism during this period. For a while, there was a reaction against the French Revolution, and you have monarchs being restored to their thrones. Now, this happened in France, in Spain, in Naples, and in Portugal. And with the return of the monarchies, the Roman Catholic position was strengthened because traditionally the church had stood behind the established authority, behind the king, and was against the spirit of revolution. So that when the monarchs here were returned, the Roman Catholic Church returned to power to a certain extent. But it was tied, you see, with the establishment. And when later on there might be revolutionary trends again, then the church is out of popularity because it's tied with the system, with the establishment. Now, something else that happened during this period was that in 1814, the Pope revived the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. Remember, they had been really outlawed. He dissolved the society for a period of time because of the feeling there was against the Jesuits. But now, there's a revival of the society. And Lateret says that during this period, too, even though Roman Catholicism is more of a minority than it used to be, it's a more fervent minority. Because these are people now that basically are working at their religion. So that during this period, there's much more practicing Roman Catholicism. There's more fervency, there's more devotion than there had been for the Roman Catholic Church as a whole since about 300. All of these centuries, there hasn't been quite the devotion and the fervency that you find during this period of time, because they were no longer as popular. Their religion was no longer as widely held. They were more of a minority. In a sense, there was more cost involved, and there was really more devotion. And this was seen, too, in the renewal of monastic life. The Roman Catholic Church, traditionally, when there's been a renewal of spiritual interest, there's been a renewal of this emphasis. Roman Catholics, if they're thinking of really becoming, quote, spiritual, will tend to think in terms of a monastery, going into a nunnery or whatever. The emphasis here being that this is the way to really live for God. So you have a surge of interestness. There are many young men going into monasteries, women becoming nuns, new orders being formed. Some were even formed for missionary work, like there's one that was called the White Fathers. The reason they were called White Fathers was they wore white garb, white robes. And the technical name was the Society of Missionaries of Our Lady of Africa. The Society of Missionaries of Our Lady of Africa. This was formed in 1868. Charles Lavigeri, who was the Archbishop of Carthage, and he was an able Roman Catholic leader here, was concerned for evangelism in Africa. So he promoted the starting of this. The goal was to evangelize the Muslims in the north of Africa and then to work on down into Africa itself. And they were quite effective in many areas. And they dressed in white like the Muslims. The thought was to identify with the people. And so they began to be called the White Fathers. Traditionally, the priests wore black, but these wore white. So you can see there's missionary outreach, and there's concern here that reaching out from the Church of Rome. There was a revival of education and scholarship in the Roman Catholic Church. Just kind of a surge in this direction, too. Those that were Roman Catholics were devout, and here there's an increased interest along these lines. And there was more lay devotion. Much more devotion now building up toward Mary. In 1854, Pope Pius IX came out with this papal decree concerning the Immaculate Conception of Mary. Now what does that mean? The Immaculate Conception of Mary. All right. Born without original sin, wasn't she? Now this, of course, increases the devotion to her. She's not just an ordinary sinner. She is someone who has, in a special way, known the hand of God. She's being removed from ordinary common man, and she's being elevated without sin. No original sin. No sin in Mary. And if that, this is true, of course, there's much more reason to venerate her and to adore her. So you have this devotion to Mary being encouraged and increasing. And along with this, you have devotion being encouraged to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. A lot of this is developing here during this period. And what was the symbol of this movement? Have you ever seen a picture that was made to cause you to think in this direction? Cheryl, have you? What is the symbol of this devotion that's supposed to call you you as a devout Roman Catholic to greater devotion to Jesus? What is the symbol that particularly is seen?
Well, it's the heart. I think there's a torch above it as pure. I don't know
that it's sort of natural. Alright. They portray literally the physical heart of Jesus, don't they? You may have a portrait of Jesus, and then you may have the heart of Jesus just being portrayed right, you know, on his chest. So that you're being made conscious of looking at the heart of Jesus. Now, what's the heart of Jesus like? Well, it's a heart of love. A heart of love that moved him to live a sacrificial life and to die a death for sinners. So that there was this devotion to the love of Jesus, and the physical heart of Jesus was pictured in a heart shape here, so that you could concentrate and think about this physical heart of Jesus as symbolizing all of his love for sinners. So you had a lot of this encouragement to devotion and to worship. And frequent communion was being encouraged. No longer simply once a week or Easter and Christmas, but in 1905, Pope Pius X invited all Roman Catholics, if you want to be devout, he said, come to daily Mass. And so you have some very devout Roman Catholics then beginning this practice of a daily Mass. If it's good once a week, it would be better every day. And you have many being involved, you see, in their religion every day in this way. I remember we lived next door to a woman. A woman was living in this house that was adjoining ours, and she was very devout. She was quite elderly, and she was nearing the end of life. She went every day to the church, their own Catholic church not too far from us. And her shoes wore out on the toes before they did on the soles. And the reason was from just rubbing her toes, I guess, as she was kneeling in the church. She spent hours in the church through the week. This spirit, you see, of devotion and thinking now, of course, that by so doing, we're going to please God. We're going to gain acceptance with God increasingly. Now, through this period, too, there was increasing authority of the Pope. Papal authority was increasing. The whole system of the hierarchy was increasing. The Roman Catholic Church was becoming a hierarchy with many branches, but all united under the Pope. And so the papal authority is increasing throughout this period. In 1869, you had a Vatican Council. It's the 20th Ecumenical Council. It was summoned by the Pope, and it was the first council since Trent, since the Council of Trent in 1563. So you can see it's been over 300 years. And this council, basically what it did, it just reaffirmed papal authority. Came out very strong for papal authority. If there's any doubt about it, as to the authority of the Pope, this settled it. For example, one of the things that was reaffirmed was, it is a dogma divinely revealed that the Roman pontiff, when he speaks ex cathedra, and what does this mean, ex cathedra? Well, it means officially, doesn't it? When he speaks, you see, from his office, as the Pope, as the vicar of Christ, when he does this, he is possessed of that infallibility with which the divine Redeemer willed that his church should be endowed. And so, once again, a strong affirmation of papal authority. And this whole thing was a part of the movement here, strengthening the authority of the Pope and the whole, the administration. Now let's just touch quickly on a few of these popes that stand out. One is Pope Pius IX, 1792 to 1878. And he became Pope in 1846. And he was conservative. Basically, his own thrust was conservative, and he fought the liberalism of current philosophy and theology, and some of it was trying to creep into the Roman Church, and he came out very strongly against it. He brought out the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, He stressed very strongly, there were some thoughts, well maybe the Protestants could possibly be right in certain areas. He reaffirmed very strongly, Roman Catholicism is the only church that's right. And you cannot please God in any other church. And another pope that came along soon after, right after him, Leo the 13th, he became pope in 1878, and he was a little more conciliatory. He was a little more liberal, willing to adjust, should we say, to the current of the day. And Pius IX was kind of reactionary, but Leo the 13th, while he held the papal authority, yet he was more conciliatory. For example, he said, now the church isn't against science. We don't want to get this idea in our heads that here is the church, we're against science. We're not. The Roman Catholic Church is not against science. And so he tried to pour oil on the troubled waters here. And not to make it seem as if here is science and here is philosophy and here is education, over here is the church, and the two will never meet. He's sometimes called the working man's pope because he came up very strongly for the rights of labor. He said the laboring men have a right to organize. They have a right to form unions. He said socialism is wrong. Leo the 13th was against socialism. But he said that certainly labor has a right to organize and labor has a right to be heard and there should be justice. Hours ought to be regulated. Women and children shouldn't be taken advantage of in connection with labor. There were just many of these areas here that Leo pressed for. So he's called the working man's pope. He was one that was interested in social action. Another pope that we think of during this period is Pope Pius X, 1903 to 1914. And Pius X took a strong stand against liberal theology. This was coming in increasingly in Protestantism. He stood very strongly against it. And they were trying to keep control of the priest. If you're going to be a priest, you must agree to the dogma of the church. You cannot accept these liberal ideas. There's not going to be room in Roman Catholicism for you if you're going that route. Now, during this period, you have, in France, you do have Roman Catholicism losing people. Numerically, they lost in France during this period of time. Some other countries gained. There were gains as far as the Catholic membership. Germany gained. There was gain in Austria. There was gain in Belgium and also the Netherlands. So you have certain areas here where the church is gaining in numbers. Spain and Portugal went through some storms, but basically they just stayed strongly Roman Catholic. And there were times when there was some anti-clerical agitation, but basically through this period, Spain and Portugal stay strongly Roman Catholic. Italy saw some drastic changes. This was the period when there was the unification of Italy, and the popes fought it. The popes were against this unification. The basic reason, I suppose, being that they realized if Italy is unified, we will lose our power and authority over our territory. If it's taken in, why then we'll be put aside. And so the Pope fought to hold his area, and until 1870, the Pope held Rome and a small area around it. He was actually supported by French troops. The French sent troops down there to help him hold on to this section. But then the French troops were withdrawn for the Franco-German War in 1870. And without his troops to help him, the Pope was finished. So in September 1870, an Italian army entered Rome. And no longer is the Pope in charge of Rome. The Italian army enters Rome. Now the next year they did pass laws to kind of protect the Pope. 1871, you have the Law of Papal Guarantees. They said the Pope could rule over the Vatican and the Lateran in Rome. Then he had a papal summer residence. And these were regarded as his territory. And because he'd lost some territory, they gave him a pretty good annual pension. And they wanted a settlement with him, see? So that there wouldn't be this hostility. But Pius IX refused to agree. He was just very unhappy about the whole thing. He refused to agree. He refused to acknowledge they had any authority there at all. Basically what he said was, give me back my territories and go away. But there wasn't this, of course, to be done. And so finally, there was a later reconciliation, and there was papal acceptance. And finally, you have a reconciliation here between the government of Italy and the Pope. What would you say is the general spirit of Italy? Cheryl, you spent some time in Italy. What would you say is the general attitude with regard to the church in Italy? Are most Italians Roman Catholic?
They are, but there's a great indifference.
All right. Okay.
You'll see a lot of empty churches. The bells ring every Sunday.
All right. A lot of empty churches, the bells ring, there's the performances put on, but very few in some of the churches. That's true. If you go into some of the large, beautiful churches, you may find just a handful of people there celebrating Mass. Maybe 10 or 12 people, and two priests. I remember seeing this in one church. You had almost more priests than you had people. And yet, here, this is supposedly a Roman Catholic country. So although nominally Roman Catholic, and of course you must be baptized as an infant and so forth, yet basically a lot of indifference. They've lived too close, and this was true of the last century, I guess they've lived too close to Rome and seen too much of all that's gone on for centuries to be greatly impressed with Christianity. Quote. So that there is this indifference. I think you put it well. Just this kind of indifference. They've been inoculated, you know. And it means nothing. Except maybe part of your national heritage, you know, it's something you ought to do, but it has no personal, vital meaning in your own life. Well, that's Roman Catholicism. I think we will not spend any more time on it. Why don't we touch quickly here on Protestantism in Europe? This is a time when Protestantism is growing, and it's able to adapt more to some of these new ideas. The Roman Catholic Church was very rigid. It was very traditional. It simply, it seemed to just stand against all these new discoveries. Thinking people were almost driven to the point of either you throw out all the sciences propounding and stand by the church, or else you get rid of the church. You couldn't seem to bring the two together. But Protestantism was much more flexible, much more congenial. Sometimes too much so. But nevertheless, the idea of democracy, the fact that here in some of these movements there's putting aside of the power of the king and an encouragement of democratic processes, this sort of thing. Protestantism was more congenial to this. They didn't have one man who was the head, functioning as a king over the whole thing, as Rome did, as the papacy did. So that the democratic idea, these trends were much more readily accepted by Protestants. And they were more open to change in areas of science. Remember the church, the Roman Catholic Church stood very strongly against the idea that, you know, the sun was the center, really, of our solar system. The planets going around the sun. At first the church said, no, the earth is the center of the universe. Everything moves around the earth. So that the Roman Catholic Church wasn't as quick to change. Now, let's notice the Protestantism in Germany, because I want to spend a little time on this. The thinking of Germany spread to Great Britain, it spread to the United States, has had an impact on Protestantism all over the world. One of the men that we think of in the early days of that century was Friedrich Schleiermacher. His last name is S-C-H-L-E-I-R-M-A-C-H-E-R, Schleiermacher. And he ended up his life as a professor at the University of Berlin. His dates were 1768 to 1834. And he was one of these early outstanding liberal theologians and had an impact throughout Germany and elsewhere. And with him, there was a step, a very strong step away from the emphasis of justification, for example, and preaching and teaching the word. And for him, this whole matter of religion could be summed up in the feeling of absolute dependence. This is what religion is, this feeling of dependence. I'm dependent on God. So religion, if I feel religious, I'm feeling dependent. Now he says feeling is basic. This is what marks us, and it marks people all over the world. And he would say the way you would structure it, your verbal characterization of it, your doctrines, your creed, these things can change. But the thing that marks religion all over is the fact that man feels dependent. So he worships. So basically, religion is a feeling rather than facts that are recorded in special revelation. He tended to have a pantheistic view of God. Now he would say this for Christianity. He'd say that Christianity is the highest form of religion. But it isn't the only form, of course, and he said this marks all religions, this sense of dependence. Christianity has simply evolved a little further than the others. Jesus Christ is not God. He's a man that Schleiermacher said was dominated by this consciousness of God. more than any man before him. So as Jesus lived and walked and taught, he was man, but he was man who was supremely conscious of God. And this now then is the stress of Schleiermacher. And redemption is simply your response in faith and love to God. But you see, he's undercut here the historic basis for Christianity. Jesus Christ is no longer the unique Son of God. And Christianity is no longer a unique, revealed faith from God. And Schleiermacher now in Germany, his teaching, his writing, his example are having a very strong influence. Some of these men were kindly, nice men. In fact, you could even say of some of them, they were kind of saintly men, religious men. But they were men that simply did not accept historic Christianity. And so these views now are being spread and disseminated. Let me mention another man, and his name is George Hegel. H-E-G-E-L. His dates 1770 to 1831. Now, he rejected Christ. He was only the human son of Joseph and Mary, so he just rejected Christianity basically as a historic belief. He said it's a philosophy that's stated in myths. That's all it is. Just a philosophy stated in myths. Some of them interesting, nice myths, but myths. And he's the one who especially saw in the universe this dialectical process. You have a thesis, and then you have an antithesis, and then the two form a synthesis. And this is the process that he saw taking place over and over in the world. And his thinking, of course, influenced many in Germany. And next time we're going to look at some of these other German thinkers who had an influence throughout the world.